Anita, how's your mental health?
Questionable at all times, you know this.
Yeah, how's the mental health of your children?
Also a little bit tricky. Can I tell you my experience in trying to find therapists for myself and my kids, Mel?
Yes, please.
Okay, this is how it goes. You ask around your friends and your family for a referral for somebody who's nearby. You finally find somebody who sounds like they might work for your family. You give them a call and you find out that A, they're not accepting new patients, or B, they have a huge wait list. So you start over again and you ask people if they know anybody who would be a good therapist and a good fit. Finally, you find one, you go and you meet with them, and you figure out that you don't actually like them that much. But it's been so much work to find somebody who you can go to in your area that you're kind of stuck with them. Well, do you have any ideas for how to get around this?
I do because guess what? I've actually had some therapists that I have found on my own, which involves what you're saying. Sometimes I remember one time I was like 3 hours in the bathtub on my phone looking through websites. I was such a prune at the end. But I have also had the experience with working with BetterHelp, and it was like I don't want to say too good to be true, but because it is true, but it's like amazing because I was matched with my therapist within 24 hours.
And you didn't have to go through all of that other ridiculous process of trying to find somebody. And here's the cool thing, too, is if that person didn't work out for you, you can just switch and say, and it's not like you're committing to another years long search for somebody who you're going to jive with.
That's true. And I lucked out, or maybe just BetterHelp is really good at matching people together because I never had to change my therapist. I loved her, perfect fit for me. And I know that some of our friends have used BetterHelp and they've had to change therapists, and boom, same day, you can change.
Easy
You can ghost your therapist, get a
peasy.
new one.
I love this idea. BetterHelp is one of our sponsors. If you use our promo code trybetterhelp.com/WWDN, you get 10% off your first month, and we totally recommend it.
Yes, get some therapy. That's
Ha.
trybetterhelp.com/WWDN.
I was gonna welcome our guest in by singing, "Here she is." Miss, nope, it wouldn't work. Our guest is not from America, so
I'm not.
I had to nix that right away. Mel, we have a fun guest today.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to her. Who is it?
Let's have her tell us who is you?
Who is I? Hello, ladies. My name is Rosie Gilmoss, and I am not in America. No, I'm in the UK. I'm in Kent, which is, to put it into perspective, not a million miles from London.
Not a million
It's
miles.
the easiest way to do.
I love it. It's kind of funny because the other day, some friends and I were trying to remember all of the different provinces in Canada. And then we did Australia. And I was like, what do they have in England, in the UK? Do you guys have states,
Counties.
provinces, counties?
Yeah.
Oh, how
And
many are
we
there?
count. Oh, don't ask me that. I haven't got a qualification in geography. I don't know. You've got sort of London in the southeast, and then you've got what's called the home counties, like Hertfordshire, Kent, Bedfordshire. So we're sort of surrounding London. This is a nice geography lesson, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we didn't even pay for this. This is extra. Okay.
So are you guys Canada or America?
America.
Do you know what? When you just said Canada, I was like, hang on a minute. I've written down that you're in America, so I just wanted to check. Thank you.
Yeah. We got 50 states. I know them all. We're good. We're good to go there. But we were checking our geography, my friend and I, for the other places that we also don't know. So.
Yeah. Well, and I've been to London and Herefordshire, and that's about all I know. Oh, and
Hereford.
Brighton.
Brighton. I've lived in Brighton for a bit. Yes, I think you fit
Oh.
in there with your blue hair.
Yes, I did not feel strange there.
No.
So
No.
great, beautiful country, lovely people.
We try. We try.
Okay, Rosie, let's back up because you're obviously here for not great reasons. So, do you want to tell us a little bit about your story?
So I, as you know, I host a podcast myself over here, which I've discovered is not dissimilar to the style of yours, which is quite nice to kind of see a familiar or hear a familiar type style. So yes, I am. My podcast is called Widowed AF. It stands for what you think it does, and I am in fact widowed. And yeah, I was widowed back in 2018. So I'm coming up to 6 years this March. Like you guys, it was a sudden death. It was a total bolt out of the blue. My my very fit, strong, healthy young husband went scuba diving one day off the English coast, which is probably not advisable. It's a bit chilly down here. And yeah, I know this is the, I learned scuba with him in Egypt and I've done, but there's no appeal to me in the English Channel. I mean, especially not now, but yeah, he went, he was a qualified, competent diver. And he went off one morning and I got a knock on the door that night. I just finished bathing the children. I had three children. They were 7, 5, and 6 months. So I was actually holding the baby when the police came to the door. And it was just like being in one of those really dramatic TV documentaries or docudramas where you're thinking, hang on a minute. No. This doesn't happen to people like me. This isn't real. And it just, the way I would describe it is my foundations just got pulled from beneath me. You know, he was my one. He was my love. We've been together for, we would have been married 10 years that year. We've been together 14 and we've built a life. You know, we'd gone from grotty little flat in London to, you know, nice house and we'd had children. And it never crossed my mind that I would lose him, especially not young. He seemed kind of invincible to me. His name was Ben, by the way. I don't know if I said his name. So yeah, I then sort of, you know, muddled through really. I relied quite heavily on alcohol. I also did train and complete a marathon. I'm not going to say I ran it, but I sort of used every coping mechanism that you possibly can to hide from this enormity of what had happened. And then as it happens, I met a fellow widower through a support group and, we had a bit of a drunken kiss and I'm now married to him. So, yeah. And there's another element to that in that he nearly died of COVID. So there's kind of a few it's been a journey. It's been a journey, but, we're pretty settled and happy. We've got four kids between us and we all live in the same house and it's carnage, but it's cool. You know? It's fun.
What is this person's name?
This is John. Jonathan Gilmas. Okay. So yes, he is, I affectionately refer to them as my dead and my alive husband, which is a little dark humoured for some to take, but I think your vibe attracts your tribe, you know? So if you don't think it's funny, then it's probably not the right podcast for you.
Yeah.
Okay, wait. You said, what was the little thing that you just said about your life? That it was something but something. I can't remember what it was.
Carnage but fun. Carnage, but fun.
That is a great tagline.
Yeah, that could be the title of the episode. But I think along this kind of, and I don't really love the word journey, but it is a journey, isn't it? You go, you know, through some peaks and troughs and you're trying to figure this out and there's no guidebook or, you know, rules of how to widow or how to grieve. And I imagine you set up the podcast because you couldn't see yourselves represented in the community. You know, it's all kind of grey-haired old people when you research widows and widowers. And I guess you just, if you can't find your tribe, you create it. And I'm lucky to have a real life tribe of widows who I met through a UK support group. But I also wanted to do something with the kind of knowledge, for want of a better word, the knowledge by experience or expert by experience, if you like. And it's taken me on a journey I never expected it to. So it's funny how life turns out, really, isn't it?
Ugh. Yeah, funny might be one word for it.
Well, funny, ha-ha, or funny, strange.
What year was it that Ben died?
It was 2018. It was March.
What? March and scuba diving in the English Channel.
Yeah.
I'm just really confused about that decision-making process. That just sounds like no fun.
You and me both. And but it was just something he did. He loved it. It was his passion. And he had his own company and he worked away maybe 1 week a month. And the rest of the time he'd be at home. And so I think men kind of, or anybody, you need a hobby or an interest, because I was kind of preoccupied with the baby yoga and all that sort of stuff. And he just loved diving. And I think this was his first dive back after having our youngest. And it just, even when there's two uniformed police officers at my door, I still don't think he's drowned. I'm still thinking he's crashed his van, he's at the hospital, what's happened? And it's like it just would not compute. And he actually has never been found, which did add quite a lot of complexities to, I don't know what your legal system's like over there in terms to bereavement, but here you need a death certificate to get access to bank accounts, life insurance, even to stop the incredibly high car payment coming out my bank every month, because I couldn't show the car dealership a death certificate, so they just kept taking the money. And it was quite scary. I say quite scary. It was absolutely terrifying. I've never been so scared in my life. But I eked out. I managed to run his business in a fairly haphazard way, but it was enough to kind of keep the kids, you know, keep the mortgage paid and all that sort of stuff. And eventually I did go to the High Court. And in the UK, if somebody goes missing, you have to wait between 4 and 6 years, I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So but they introduced a new law, which is you have to go to the High Court to get it, and it's called a presumption of death. And I was only the second person to obtain one of these. And that in itself, you know, walking into the High Court where the only positive outcome is going to be a piece of paper that confirms your husband is dead. I just made me go goosebumpy, actually, because I look back on that time and I think, how did I do that? And the title of your podcast, What Do We Do Now? Like, what do you do? You know, you just keep going, don't you? And you keep facing all these obstacles, but it's tough. And I think people see the surface and they see, you know, that you might have your lipstick on, or you might be running triathlons, or you might be, you know, international jazz pianist, but you are still absolutely shattered inside. But you can't let the world see that all the time. You can't live like that.
That day he went swimming, but that night you found out he was dead, but there was no body. And so then what? How did they even know?
Yeah.
So he went out on a dive, an organized trip. So you did ask me why I do scuba diving off the English coast. We have a lot of wrecks. We have a lot of wrecks from the war. So the dive community would like to go. They like to go and look at a wreck. I mean, it's not my cup of tea, I have to be honest with you. So he was out on a boat. They changed location because the tide was a little choppy, which was the kind of first complication. And then I found out sort of, I think it was nearly 3 years later at the inquest, that he'd actually been sick on the boat, and he really shouldn't have gone in the water. I don't know whether you guys dive or not. I used to. And he also went in alone. So everybody else was buddied and he went in on his own. And when I found out that, I was so angry with him. So angry, because those are just two fundamental mistakes. And the belief is, we don't know, that he removed his regulator to be sick, which in turn would have caused him to inhale water. The only kind of positive from this is it would have been quick. It wouldn't have been a prolonged death. But like I say, we don't really know. It was all to do with anecdotal evidence. You know, they'd seen him go in the water. He hadn't resurfaced. I'm also quite cross because it happened in the morning and I didn't find out till 7 p.m., which is why this, but we weren't that kind of live in your pocket couple. Like we didn't have to message each other all day. And I think I'd probably sent him a couple of messages going, "You all right?" You know, but I assumed he'd phone had left it in the van or something. In fact, I stood in the school playground picking up my two boys. And I said to one of the other mothers, as you do, "God, you know, if Ben dropped dead tomorrow, I'd have no idea who to pay the electric and gas to." And he was already dead. And, you know, those little ironies and things or synchronicities that you find out afterwards, it's a funny old game, grief, isn't it?
Sometimes we assume that unless we had a huge life insurance payout, we don't really need to know anything about investments or even finances. But guess what? A little knowledge of finances is critical for all of us. Maybe your partner was in charge of that stuff, and now you find yourself making all the decisions. Maybe you're mad about that. Maybe I am. Nicole from the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast is here to help. She tackles financial literacy by telling the stories of women and widows and finance experts, and shares the lessons they've learned as certified financial planners. Whether you know a lot and feel confident in your financial decisions or feel unsure about all of that stuff, there is more to learn. Listen and subscribe to the He's Gone But the Money's Not podcast on all podcast platforms. This ad was paid for by Rockhouse Financial, an SEC-registered investment advisor.
So I'm curious, they came and they told you that he was missing, or did they came and told you that he was dead?
No, they knocked on the door and the first thing they said, I don't talk about this often, actually, this particular bit, is the first question is, "Are you Rosie Moss, as I was then, wife of Ben Moss?" And I got in the between, sort of coming down my stairs, and I had a glass in my door. I could see, in the time it took me to put the dog into the living room and come back out, it had registered that they were police. And I think at that moment, you know that no good is coming of this. and they were young. I you end up feeling sorry for them, like offering up a cup of tea and things like, I didn't have a bra on, you know, and I was like really self-conscious.
Me too.
Yeah, all these weird things, and you're thinking, why do I care about this? But you find, your brain will find other things for you to do, won't it, and think about. And they said he was missing, and there I entered into this world, and I actually spoke to a Coast Guard who was very frank with me. And he, I said to him, what are the chances of him being alive? This is about 10 o'clock that night. And he said, I'm going to be honest with you, in those conditions, zero. Mm. And I just remember it just making a noise, you know, the noise, right? And just thinking, shit, what am I going to tell the kids? Like, that's the first thing that comes into my
what
head.
What did you tell them in the beginning
and when?
Yeah.
So when the police came, my daughter was obviously a baby. And then I had one who was five who may have been, it's all a bit blurred, to be honest with you. You think it would be crystalline, but it isn't. And the eldest one, who's now 13, he asked me what was going on. And in that instant, I said, oh, they've come about the dog. Like, you don't know what to say, because I didn't actually know that he was dead. I didn't know anything. I just knew that the police were at my door with bad news. And it did cause actually some quite, it caused a bit of unpicking that, because I had told him a fundamental lie, and I operate very much on a truth based in this house, and it did take some unpicking. So I got the kids to bed. My friends come round. The police have called a friend round for me. My parents are in South America. Of course they are, off on some jolly somewhere remote. And I sat up all night, and this is really kind of, this is like something you would see in a film, you know, sitting, the rain's hammering down and the blind, and I'm looking at the moon and I'm thinking, can you see it? You know, are you cold? All I kept thinking is, you're going to be so cold. And Googling, how do you tell your children that their dad died? And the overwhelming sort of research showed me that you have to be as blunt and as honest as you can. And you have to use words like dead. You can't, particularly in a circumstance like mine, I can't say missing, I can't say lost, because I kind of figured, say dead, and then, you know, best case, he comes home and I say, oh, sorry. But if I let them have hope, and hope is very, hope is really important in life, but it's very damaging in a situation like this, because if you kept hoping, how could I possibly have continued my life? And don't get me wrong, every now and then there'll be a little flicker of what if, you know, what if he was picked up somewhere? What if he's lost his memory?
What if he swam across the English Channel
in a full wetsuit,
holding onto a volleyball,
and now he lives in France and he eats
with a wife called Claudette?
It was all a scam.
It was all a scam, yeah.
Yes. You know, it's really interesting, because you're kind of right with the kids. Like, for adults to hope, they have hope, but they also have reasoning behind that. And for kids, if they have hope, they're 100% in on that hope. You know, you can't say, like, we have a 5% chance that he might be coming home. If you say, like, if you ever say to a child, we might be going to do something fun, that means 112% you're going to do something fun.
And they will remember it till they die.
Yeah, you cannot commit at all unless you're going to commit all the way. So it would almost be better to err on the side of horribleness and just go straight to dead, instead of like, maybe dad's dead. It's like, he's dead, and if not, then we're gonna have to do some therapy about how people come back from the dead, but that's fine, we'll deal with that.
Yeah, well, this is what I thought I'll unpick that mess if it happens, but right now I have to give them clarity, consistency, and I'm in a way, I'm quite proud that I did that for them, because I don't know how, and none of us know really how we pick up the pieces when this happens, but you do somehow. And people talk about being strong, and, you know, you're so resilient, and you've heard all these, right? And you almost get a bit fed up of it, I think. I'm sure you probably discussed this yourselves, but you think, I it's not a choice I'm making. If I'm not strong and I don't get up and I don't get the kids to school and I don't feed them, they die. You know, there is nobody's going to swoop in, no Nanny McPhee's coming to take over. The buck stops with me. But I do think that's why, and I don't know if it's necessarily just mothers or fathers, or if it's universal, because I could only speak from my own experience, but it does mean you put your own grief on hold. The whole kind of airplane metaphor doesn't really apply in this. You check them first, and then you figure your shit out later. That was my experience.
My experience was that the plane was like crashing and we were all just yelling at the same time.
And burning.
Yeah. It was like going down around.
There was a fair bit of that, I'm not going to lie to you.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, we have friends whose husbands have gone missing, and the thought of having to wait, I think it's 7 years here before somebody can be declared dead. And I'm not sure if they have ways to like say, no, really, they probably are. But that introduces a whole other level of WTF to it, you
Barf.
know? Yeah, I'm
Yeah.
glad in quotes that you were able to get around that, but holy cow.
But the other thing is, I have a friend who's a lawyer and she did the work pro bono. She's quite high up in quite a prestigious law company. And so she very foolishly said to me, if there's ever anything I can do.
Oh.
And this ended up being much more complicated than she expected. Now, she did it for me pro bono, and in the hope that, if there was a litigation case, we would claim against the skipper of the boat. We didn't. And actually, in the High Court, the judge sort of, it was really quick. He said, I've read your paperwork. And he said, of course, I'm going to give you this death certificate. And he looked at the barrister, or I'm never sure which way around it is, and said, I hope you're going to reduce your fees. Because obviously, they put the full whack, which was something like £25,000. Now, if you don't have a friend that's a lawyer, or you don't happen to be sitting on a pile of cash, you're waiting 7 years. I'd have lost my house. I'd have lost, the life insurance he had didn't cover the mortgage. I don't even know how he did that, but it meant that I only had a very small mortgage, so I could stay in my home. I have moved since, but it gave me that security. But I had to wait 3 years. It was a Everything has felt like a fight. Every door just kept getting slammed in my face. Nobody would offer me support for the kids. I had my mum and dad sitting on hold to various companies, explaining why I wouldn't be able to pay bills that month. It was very infantilizing and very, very scary.
How old are your kids now? You said
They
13.
so yeah, he'll be 14 in April. And then I have Hector, who is 11, and I have an adopted daughter through my marriage called Holly, who's 10, and I have Tabitha, who is 6.
Oh my goodness. You have the same, some of your kids are the same age as mine. And in fact, I have a son turning 14 in April as well.
Oh, do you?
Do you want a swap?
Oh,
Just
no,
an
mine's
idea.
lovely.
Ah, shoot.
No, mine's really nice. You can have one of the others, but not
That's funny.
that one.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the aftermath and meeting John and the timeline for all of that?
Of course. So initially, I thought this was it now. I'm going to be on my own and I'm going to be sad. And in a weird sort of way, I was okay with that because I genuinely thought that the pain I felt was equivalent to the love I felt, and that was kind of my future. And I think because all I knew about widows was fairy tales, Disney stories, books, I didn't know anybody my age that had been widowed. And I also was very aware of the judgment that comes at you, either because you've talked about widow's fire, I assume, at some point in your podcast. So it is a thing. It's a legitimate thing. It happens to almost everybody I know who's been widowed. But you also are very aware of kind of not looking like you don't care, or that you're a bit of a harlot, or that whereas actually it's not connected at all. And so I dabbled in online dating just to see what it was really, because it didn't exist when I met Ben, but that was a fairly horrible place. And John and I were friends. He lives in Kent as well, or lived in Kent at the time. He still does because we live together. And it was his birthday. So I just said on this kind of WhatsApp group, I'll take you out something to eat, just as friends. And I don't know, because we perhaps knew everything about each other, because it was much like I imagine your Facebook community is. We bared our souls. He knew of all the bad decisions I'd made. He knew how badly I was hurting, and I the same. And so you sort of went into it with a core of a understanding. And I'm not going to lie to you, it hasn't been easy. We got married in lockdown. We eloped and just got married at the registry office because of his close. He had a very close encounter with COVID. So I'm not jinxed, I swear. And we got married just to kind of formalize it, make it official. And also just to give the kids that sort of feeling of security. And for us as well, I'm a bit old to be referring to a boyfriend, It's much easier to say a live husband. And we fell in love, and it's a different love. It's a grown-up love. I'm not at university anymore. I'm an adult woman, and I've been to hell and back. So we've had to support each other through some quite tough stuff, because particularly when I stopped drinking, I felt everything again. And And John's had to go back and unpick some childhood trauma, because of course you go into therapy and they find all sorts, right? You don't just go in and, you know, talk about your bereavement. But we've formed this very tight family unit. There's six of us in the house, and a dog and cats. And we're very lucky. We live in a lovely place in Kent, and we have, I would say, a happy, contented life. But of course, everything you do for the rest of your life will come with that caveat of but.
How did John's wife or partner die?
So his wife died from bowel cancer. So she was exactly the same age as me. So she was 37, and she died, you know, in a fairly brutal way. And her little girl was 5 when she died. And her little girl is now my little girl. But I'm not her mummy. Her mummy is dead, and I am her mum. And that's how she made the distinction.
So I'm curious, because I think there's got to be a slightly different dynamic between you, whose husband was here and then gone, and between his wife, who went through a long-term, is she going to survive, is she not, you know, hope and then loss and then hope and then loss and then finally her death. Do you guys have different grieving styles and patterns, and because of that experience that's different?
I think we naturally do anyway. I think just in the nature of, I'm much more a talker. He's talked a lot more since he's been coming on the podcast with me. But yeah, I think he knew that he was going to be widowed, obviously, in advance, because it was terminal. And he had to watch her suffer. And he had to watch this strong, vivacious woman turn into a skeleton and angry because of the drugs. You know, the indignity of even losing your personality at the end. So I think for him, he wasn't kind of married towards the end, if that makes sense. He'd almost transition to carer, which is not to say it diminished any of the grief at the end, because of course when that blow comes, it comes just as hard however it lands. But again, that's left complications, because, you know, we don't know how much Holly remembers from the time. You kind of don't want to go digging too deep in case you actually trigger some memories. But we they've all had therapy, we have therapy, and we do the work. And I didn't always do the work. I used to do the work as in drinking a bottle of gin. But now I do the cold water, the exercise, the meditation, you know, all the stuff that I would have absolutely rolled my eyes at 6 years ago. I find myself, I got in the ice bath this evening before I came on because I needed to perk myself up. So,
okay, so this is really kind of humorous to me, because I would have explained it the same way. It's like the things that I would have rolled my eyes at before are the things that actually help you heal. And they're hard work and they suck. And it makes me so mad. It's like, I don't want to do yoga, and I don't want to go jump in a cold lake, and I don't want to meditate.
And I don't want to listen to it.
Seriously. So yeah, good job for doing those things. They are hard, and shout out.
And it's called work, isn't it? You know, you do the work, and there's a reason for that. And I think you go in with an expectation that you can perhaps have 6 weeks of counselling and you'll unpack all your grief and you'll be fine. But like I said, you often find more in there. For me, a lot came from my undiagnosed autism ADHD, because as somebody else described it to me, it's just not being able to hide it anymore. And it just comes out. And I think that's kind of what happened with me. And I know I've referred to it, but the drinking masked so much of who I was that actually I've kind of had to find out that as well, without sounding too wafty and hippie. But it has led me down the yoga and meditation and cold water therapy route. And do you know what? I'm cool with that, because it beats, you know, rolling in at 3 a.m. and feeling shit for 4 days. So I'll take it.
What led you to decide that you needed to quit drinking? Like, what was the bop on the head that finally
I didn't
made
have
you do
what
it?
You would call a rock bottom moment. I had an accumulation of sort of lows, and it tipped from, you know, that party girl persona that I had created into, I don't know, more embarrassing drunk, I suppose, perhaps my pride. I think I've always known I would have to stop drinking. I've always had a slight problem with alcohol. It was exacerbated when Ben died. But it was beginning to take more than it gave. So I'm not a one glass or a two glass. If I can't have the bottle, I don't want it. So for me, I tried moderation, and, you know, I'm only drinking at the weekends and all that sort of thing. And essentially, I come from a line of alcoholics. I have ADHD, which, you know, predisposition to addiction. And it just became something that was going to take my new life from me. You know, whether it be literally or metaphorically, it was not going to help me heal. And it was, I actually just mentioned to my son something about, I was on a podcast, sobriety podcast, and he said, oh, I don't really remember you drinking, maybe once with your friend Jen. And I thought, oh, that's really good though, because it means that they don't remember. I sort of nipped it in the bud just in time. But we talk quite openly about it because obviously they have a susceptibility towards problematic behaviors because, you know, I did.
Oh, man.
Question. If you're willing to talk about this, I know that you referred to being married, you and John, it hasn't been easy. You guys both obviously have complicated stories. Will you talk to us about some of those things for those who are curious how two widowed people can work together with that?
Yeah. And it is something that people do ask us quite a lot because you don't stop loving the person that died. And that's a really strange dynamic because I don't know, Prince Charles and Camilla and Diana, the famous quote was, there's three of us in this marriage. And actually there's four of us in this marriage and there's pictures of them in the house. I was feeling really sad and I had like a picture next to my bed. You know, I don't normally do that. That's a little step too far, but sometimes you need that connection to them. And I text Ben and John knows I text Ben. But yeah, the complications would come around things like parenting, you know, because you are coming at this with adopted children and he went from having one to having four. I went from having three to having four. But these children came with baggage. And I have a son who's autistic and he's absolutely amazing now. But back then he was very, I guess he was hurting and I didn't know at the time what it was. So it's, and we moved house and he referred to the COVID, but he came home from hospital after a month in ICU, unable to walk, unable to feed himself, unable to go to the bathroom himself. So that I went, it's kind of, you know, the initial romance, you know, we were popping over to New York and stuff to suddenly having a patient at home. So that, you know, but everything that doesn't kill you and all that is a cliche. But I think if you survive those things, you generally can get through the others. And talking, but yeah, we don't have so much like an issue with jealousy or anything like that. And we didn't really face any animosity or judgment that we know of. I'm sure there was some people having a little chatter behind our backs, but I think most people who genuinely care about you saw that it made our lives better for everybody, not just me and John, but the children. And, you know, haven't replaced Ben, but my kids have now got a male figure that they can look up to and is kind to them and models good, you know, male behavior and a healthy relationship. And actually that it is important. It's not the be all and end all, but it is, if you can find love again, why the hell would you not? Right.
I'll tell you why I right now am not doing it. And it's because I have taken over all of Jason's drawers in the dresser and all of his closet space. And I don't know if I can give that back up. They're going to have,
we bought a new house.
Yeah. I mean, that's a real issue for me. I'm like, no, I need all this space now and you're dead. So I get to have all the drawers.
Yeah. Do you know what? It's funny you say that because Ben had this hideous chest of drawers. I hate it. It was just this horrible like pine chest of drawers. And it was probably one of the first things I got rid of because I was like, oh, at least I can get rid of the chest then.
Yeah.
It sounds so horrible and sort of cruel, but you do. You think, oh, okay, that can be gone. And I bagged up all his stuff into massive suitcase. And then I think it was maybe a year and a half ago, I had little bears made for the children out of his clothes. Because you have all this stuff, don't you? And you think, what on earth do I do with this? Because I don't want to create a shrine, but I also want and actually saying that, Ben didn't have a huge amount of stuff. If I went, there'd be bin bags full of the stuff. And one of the things I really would have liked was his wedding ring. But then I suppose there's something nice about the fact that he's still wearing it because he would have had gloves on. But yeah, I had my own wedding ring remade and I wear that on my right hand. And, you know, we muddle through. We're learning on the job.
Wow.
Will you tell us how your podcast came to be? When after the death did this come?
So I have a degree in journalism and I've always wanted to do some writing, but I've never really had the confidence or the commitment, you know, blank page syndrome, right? And I just had this idea, Christmas, not the one just gone, the one before. And I called my best friend, Lulu, who's also a widow. And I said, do you want to do a podcast with me? I have no clue what I'm doing, but we can figure it out. And we did. We started off with an iPad on a towel, you know, to try and help the reverberation. And now I got my full little setup going on. We recorded our own stories. We interviewed each other and then I interviewed John and it just began to grow. And we had this application process and suddenly we were booking like 6 months in advance because people wanted to come and tell their stories. And I think there is this inherent need to A, tell their story, tell their legacy, say their name, but also to let the non-widowed community understand what it's actually like. And I guess to find community, to find kindred spirits. And it's that's what it did. And Lulu, she did drop off the podcast, not because we fell out, but just for her, she's on her own and it was just too much of a commitment. And I've just kind of kept turning up at the microphone and interviewing and putting it out, and people have been listening, and suddenly, you know, we got 50,000 downloads, and I haven't actually done any advertising or anything, so I don't make any money out of it, but one day. And I would like to do that book at some point. You know, that's in my, it's in my vision, but it's a tough thing to do, isn't it? To get pen on paper or type.
Yeah. So I have to tell you, this is so funny. We have shirts, and one of our shirts that Mel designed says resilient AF, and our mothers are tender hearted, delicate little flowers. And Mel's mom said, "What does AF mean?" And Mel immediately said, "American Fork," which is a city near us.
So in Utah, and everyone calls it AF. So
So it's like resilient American Fork, which totally makes sense. And she
makes
just was like,
"No sense."
She's like, "Oh, that's so nice," and went along her merry way. So now I always laugh about the AF because it's just.
Well, I've written down American Fork because we did. Initially, we went on. I don't know if you're familiar with the BBC in the UK. It's like our main broadcasting channel, and we have ones for each county. So there you go, you get more geography. So we went on BBC Southeast, and of course, it's quite a. I guess an older audience, more traditional audience, the BBC. And they said to us just before we went on air, "What does AF stand for?" And we went, "As friends."
Yes.
Oh, man. That's funny.
Okay. So your story, Rosie, sounds a little similar to our podcast beginning story. We can totally relate with the blanket. We made a fort with the laptop and we hid under it. And we were both like, should we do this? And it took a minute for Anita to get on board, and then we did. And you find out, as it helps people, that's what helps keep you going.
Yeah, and it helps you, right? It helps you because I never thought of myself as like a do-gooder, you know. And you almost feel kind of embarrassed when people are going, "Oh, you know, you're doing so much good," and you sort of think, "Oh, no, I'm just talking. Like, these people are telling their stories." But I suppose what we have done and you have done is given people a vehicle to tell their stories and a space that's safe and non-judgmental. And, you know, even at the beginning when you said to me, "Oh, you know, don't worry if you say something you regret, we can edit it out." And I thought, I do exactly that to my guests, exactly that. I say, I have this, you know, "Please don't worry if you say anything you don't like, I can take it out. Or, you know, if you want to add anything." And it's really weird how the similarities are. I said to you at the beginning, I swear I didn't copy you. I didn't.
Hey, we've all kind of been muddling through life kind of in the same manner. So makes sense. We totally get what our brains are not working. And for somebody to come on a podcast and talk about their story, they might be nervous and they want to make sure they're saying the right things. They might stutter over their words. So yeah, it's all right. And
they might go off on a tangent. That's all there's
that. Totally. That's the best part.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it's so interesting because when we tell our stories, sometimes it's the little things that somebody will connect with also. It's not the big grand ideas or, you know, what we've learned. It's like you saying that you didn't have a bra on when the police came and you're like, "I don't have a bra on." Like, I had that same kind of like, "Oh, I'm not wearing a bra." And it's just like those little things that we connect over and you're like, "Yeah, totally." And then I went to the hospital and I didn't have any socks on. And that's all I could think about was that I wasn't wearing any socks in my shoes and my feet were sweaty. And it's just like weird stuff like that connects and draws you closer and makes you feel like you're not a crazy person and that your experience is valid and that somebody else can witness your story. And then they have a little piece of that person too. So it's a really cool thing.
And I think it also gives you a platform to talk a little bit about your love, because when you lose somebody, and especially if you do get into another relationship, you can feel like it's almost taboo to talk about how much you love them, because I haven't stopped loving them. That hasn't stopped. But I also didn't stop loving my first child when I had my second or my third or my inherited a fourth, because love is a peculiar thing and the human heart is an incredible thing. And it does have the capacity to expand. And that's not to say that, you know, there aren't, if we've had a row, but I'm not like, "Oh, I wish Ben was here." But, you know, that's normal. That's just a normal human reaction. But I wanted to ask you just, Anita, particularly, but just out of curiosity, because one of the things that comes up repeatedly with children who are bereaved is we find that they make kind of this awful noise and then they go off and do something really like normal. And you look at them and you think, are you a psychopath? You don't just
100%. 100 times a day, I ask myself that question.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, you know, they don't grieve in any way that you think they should be grieving.
No.
You know, they're like, I want to go to school today. And you're like, what? Your dad just died. And they're like, well, it's, you know, we're doing a science experiment that I want to do. And you're just confused.
Well, book day here.
Yeah.
Harry Potter costumes, off they went. And I was just thinking, this is so bizarre. Like, yeah. My kids are dressed as Harry Potter and my husband died yesterday. But you have to kind of, again, so I actually recorded, I haven't released it yet, an interview with a friend of mine who lost her dad young, not as young as my kids, but fairly young. And I wanted to find out from her perspective, you know, what should we do and what shouldn't we do? And one of the key things was that kind of forced grieving that we do, you know, on the anniversary, we sort of say, oh, you know, it's the date of your dad's death or their birthday. And I've stopped doing that, and I let them kind of, I acknowledge the day and my eldest knows the date, but the others don't. And I don't want to sort of force grief on them unnecessarily. I think it'll come in, you know, they'll process it in their own way, in their own time. And Hector, who he goes to a specialist school, which does support children who've had a catastrophic event happen, as well as support the autistic side of things. So he gets lots of support now. He's fairly new to the school. And my eldest did did some work with a charity called Holding or Letting Go that helped children. But little one, she hasn't had anything yet. And I'm thinking it's probably time, actually, because she must have so many questions. And she's very, very precocious. So I get asked a lot of questions. But I can't imagine going up not knowing who the person that made you was. And not, you know, I'm so close to my dad that I really grieve that for her. Because, you know, my dad wrapped me in my arms, you know, and helping, and her dad will never be able to do that for, well, none of them, but at least the others sort of had a bit, they've got real memories, whereas hers are learned.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious if your kids have any ill feelings towards the water, or if they are scared of that, or if they have any feelings. Nope.
Nope. Yeah. The little psychopaths were playing some sort of underwater game within days on the computer. And no, Monty at the time was booked in to do diving, as in off a diving board course, mm-hmm. just at the local swimming pool. And I carried on. My mum took him. Actually, I didn't take him. And no, they haven't. And actually, the first Christmas I took them into the sea, I was in Cape Verde and I took them into the sea. And that was the first time I've been in. And I have been in the channel since. And I sort of did not, they can all swim competently. We have a swimming pool at home. So that was really important as well. And it's, so they have the skills to survive, but then so did Ben. You know, he was a competent swimmer. It doesn't guarantee your safety. And all I can do is say to them, just please don't scuba dive. You know, that's my line in the sand, be in the water. And things like if they have kids, friends around in the summer, and the pool is quite a new addition to the house. And there is no second warning. If I tell you to stop doing something and you don't stop, you are out, because it's my anxiety can't cope, basically. So
yeah.
How about you?
I don't have any issues.
It wasn't a direct cause, was it? I realize that I'm now asking you a question, but I'm going to see if you guys want to come on my podcast as well. But your husband was like swimming laps, and I'm presuming because of your interest in triathlons and things that you were quite a fit, healthy couple.
Yeah.
So what happened? You don't have to tell me. I'm just
I'll tell you. Sudden cardiac death where they have a heart arrhythmia that's fatal. And we found out he had a heart defect that we didn't know about. So his heart was working a lot harder than it should have. And there's like a whole cascade of events that happen in that. But yeah, so he just got out of the water, said he felt yucky and collapsed and died. And they tried to get his heart started again and just couldn't. So
it's, I am. And but for both of you and Mel, you know, I had to Google what a tonsillectomy was because I didn't know what that was. And I did not know that people died from it. I mean,
you're not supposed to.
Yeah.
But it's, I've really interviewed somebody whose wife died in childbirth. You know, I think it gives you a bit of a fear because you're uncertain. You have no faith in the world around you anymore because bad things do happen. But also, you know that bad things do happen and you can survive it. I didn't think I would have survived something like this. I mean, I don't know what I thought I'd do, but the idea of me, you know, running a business and running a household and, you know, taking control of my own finances and all the aspects that I kind of defaulted to him, I've had to learn how to do. And I say learning on the job in more ways than one.
There's a lot that we learn just by going through widowhood. And you donate your time right now to do a podcast for widows. How has that enhanced or not enhanced your life with your own recovery or I guess we're always in recovery from grief, right? And I'm asking this because I get asked this a lot, and it's usually from people who they're like, oh, you have a podcast for widows still? It's been 6 years since Scott died. And they ask the question with kind of funny look at me, like they're expecting me to say that it's hung up my healing recovery. Yeah. And it absolutely has not. It's enhanced it. So I would like to ask you the same thing, but without the weird stare.
No, I like the weird stare. I like it. I get asked it a lot by people generally who are concerned that perhaps, particularly because I have, and I've talked about this quite a bit, I've had a couple of mental health crashes this year. And, you know, one ended up with me at A&E. They were absolutely useless, by the way. But people would say, oh, do you think this is because of the podcast? Do you think that living in other people's grief is perhaps starting to have a negative impact? And maybe some of it, maybe, because, you know, sometimes it is difficult and you are, but I am finding I'm able to sort of not take it on as much. And I do have the therapy as well, which helps. And I will continue to do that, I think, as long as I do this. But yeah, mostly it's sort of, you know, aren't you kind of getting stuck in this narrative and pigeonholed into the grief arena? But actually, I just think I'll put out 100 episodes next week or the week after. And every single person I've spoken to has been fascinating and inspiring, because it doesn't matter how their partner died or what relationship they had before or how they've fixed themselves. Every story is just so interesting. And I think, as a general rule, widows are a tough bunch. And we are compassionate because we know what it is like to lose the thing that means everything to us. And unless you've had that happen to you, you can't possibly know. So to answer your question a little bit more concisely, I have found a tribe of people that I didn't know existed. I have laid my soul bare in a way that I never imagined I would. I was quite private about things, unless I was pissed. And and all it's done is brought good things, you know? It's brought good people into my life. It's brought a career that's launching, you know, that I never thought I would broadcast, but here I am. And it's given me purpose, I suppose. Not that I didn't have purpose before, but maybe a professional purpose. So yeah, it's been difficult sometimes. I've had panic attacks on the mic, you know. I did one, American lady, actually, Canadian, sorry, called Laurie, and her husband drowned too. And minutes before being on the mic, I'm shaking and, you know, my hands are going and I'm sweating. Mic goes on and there you go. So I don't know whether there's an element of masking involved, but it's certainly brought more than it's taken. Let's say that.
Oh, I love that. Tell us where we can find your podcast and remind us what it's called.
It's called Widowed AF, and you can find us at any of your usual podcast channels. You just type in Widowed AF. We have Instagram, widowed_AF. I'm not massively competent at social media, I'm not going to lie. I'm trying. Oh, do you know what? It just feels so it's just so alien to me, this idea that you have to almost like beg people to like your page. And I'm like, oh, fuck off. They'll either like it or they won't.
That's what gives me panic attacks, not the widows, just social media.
I'm just like, we just have limited time and this is not where our time is going to go. So,
and then I put something out this morning and I realized I've made typos in it and I'm really anal about spelling. And I thought, oh no, I've just made myself sound stupid. So yeah, it's a funny old world, but I also have my personal Instagram account, which is Rosie Gil Moss. And I will be putting out some podcasts that aren't grief related under that banner as well.
Well, thank you so much, Rosie, for sharing with us and also for staying up late, since it's late.
Well, I mean,
you are.
It's 10 p.m.
Oh, don't tell him. Make him sound like it's really late.
We have one final question for you. Mm-hmm. What is your favorite cheese?
Camembert.
She answered that so quickly.
That was spot on.
No question. Little bit stinky. Bit of apple or pear with it, maybe. Bit of fig jam. How about you?
Sounds delicious. Oh, you can't turn that question on us. There's
I do
no
like
answer.
Red Leicester cheese. Like cheddar.
I look at me. I'm like,
I feel like you should know that because
no, I do
Leicester,
know Red Leicester,
right?
I do, yeah, Red Leicester, and that's actually in the sort of Midlands of the country. If we're carrying on with our geography lesson,
mm-hmm. yes. I love it. Well, thank you so much, Rosie. It's been a delight to talk to you. Good luck with all the stuff that you've got going right now. It's always fun to juggle all of those different balls.
Oh yeah, you've got to spin some plates, man. That's the only way to do it.
Thanks for listening today. If you guys want to keep the podcast going, consider joining our Patreon. It's patreon.com/www.
UDN. If you'd like to buy us tacos, go to buymeacoffee.com/widowwedonow.
And if you don't want to do either of those things, just give us a nice rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And until we get to talk to you again, I'm Anita.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Rosie.
And we're just two young widows and one young widow who happens to be an expert in English geography. And we're all just trying to figure out widow.
We
do
now. This is my favorite thing to discuss with you.
Tell me, what is it?
One of my favorite things. I do enjoy tacos and cheese and dogs. This is about how you cannot pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars for a phone plan, especially when you're a widow, your person is dead, you might have kids, you might need another option, and you just want your phone to work, you want unlimited texting and service, and you want it to be like $25 a month.
It blows my mind that they have plans that start at $15 a month. That is so cheap. And the cool thing is it uses other 5G networks, and so you don't have to pay extra for that, and you still get great service.
Yep. Anita and I have traveled all over, and I have used my phone. So I highly recommend it. And my mom's even on it. When my dad died, we put his phone down to the cheapest plan, which is $15 a month. And I think my mom's on the $20 a month plan, and it's so worth it. It's so much cheaper than what we were all paying before. So I highly recommend it if you're on a budget or not. Who cares? Ryan Reynolds is in charge of the company, and they send you free stickers with Ryan Reynolds temporary tattoos. It's kind of the best. So if somebody wants to sign up, what can they do, Anita?
Go to trymintmobile.com/WWDN. Seriously, you guys, such a great idea. Save yourself some money.
And if you're worried about losing data or having any changes with your phone, not going to happen. They walk you through it. Everything's fine. It's the easiest process of all time. Again, that's
trymintmobile.com/WWDN.